LeBron, my favorite follow on the court and on the social media sphere. Just
sorry.
Thank you.
so deep, oh, I will the darkness sweep. Ya-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Everybody, are we awake?
I think so.
Okay. All right. I got inspired to play a piece that was a documentary that came out not too long ago, and it's got a lot of Bernie Sanders in it. We talked about Bernie Sanders. Our sister Ahalia got to go to the event this weekend in New York. So, or Connecticut. I guess it was Connecticut. But it just inspired because I've been thinking about playing this. I'm not going to play the whole thing. I'm just going to play some of it. But it's still about 40 minutes, and it's about our situation and what we need to do. And Bernie Sanders is giving them a good old shot in the arm. So let's just listen to this. This is from the title of the piece that was put. It's called Forward 13. Waking Up America. And the filmmaker is Patrick Lavelle. And he embarks on a cross-country journey to find out what happened to America. Ha ha. And what first got him going is that he got a foreclosure notice. And that took him for a loop. I didn't play the first part of it, but now you know that much. So then it makes sense, the rest of it. Here we go. Okay.
To be here with you today! my son's voice reminded me of my place in this world, and a recurring theme that I kept hearing throughout the journey: taking responsibility for one's actions. My wife never signed up to be dragged through this madness, but when it all caved in, she stood by my side. And I don't know if there's anything more important than commitment. The purpose to get on the road was to get out of my bubble in my quest to find the truth, to connect the dots in a tangible way that made sense, like teaching my son the fundamentals. The truth was staring me right in the face. You don't know where you're going until you know where you've been. And this journey enabled me to connect the dots of my own life while connecting the dots of this moment in American history. Our destiny is the sum total of our actions. I was rocked by the economic meltdown like millions, but I had to be accountable for jumping into a home without a stable income or longevity in a position. I didn't have to pursue a business that was risky by nature. If my family was so important to me, maybe I should have become an accountant or a dentist. Maybe I should have followed in my father's footsteps to become an attorney in the fossil fuel business. Had I achieved that, maybe things would have turned out differently. Maybe not. But if America wasn't the nation of entrepreneurs and dreamers, America wouldn't be what it is today, and the American dream would be irrelevant. If what we discovered is true, then what I discovered is that this isn't about right or left. It's about right or wrong. If the oil companies and the banking industry have enough influence to buy our Congress to create outcome and influence for their bottom line, where does that leave our democracy? If Congress serves the corporate interest, then what value does our vote have? The point is, we have to take action. The purpose of our patriotism is to enlighten and inspire us to do something about it. We learned that one-third of the world's GDP is dependent on the oil spigot, and these resources will end. Demand will spike, supply will diminish, but our planet's hydrocycle is at a tipping point, and that will have a significant impact on both your and my family's future. But we can change this direction. It's about how we choose to live. What world do we want to live in? I want to live in a just and decent world where everyone matters. And in the United States, I believe that everyone should be able to rise to the highest levels of success that they're capable of reaching, but without throwing the rest of us under the bus. The experiences that led to this journey frequently felt like the end of my world, but this journey had become my rebirth. And now I felt humbly insignificant compared to being a part of this monumental moment in our nation's history. America has always been a country of contradictions, and maybe that's why Wall Street couldn't answer a fair question. Is it fair? Like I said in the beginning, I never thought the world owed me anything, but I did believe in myself and the American dream. We have core fundamental problems that has our nation and this dream on its knees. But like the good friends that I've made on this journey said, it's too big to fail now. We have the opportunity, and I believe the obligation, to use our patriotism to save our democracy, the American dream, and our place on this planet. And in so doing, can rise from the ashes to become the next greatest generation. We can achieve what emboldened the spirit of our forward-thinking founding fathers and the original 13 colonies in order to form a more perfect union. Some think it's the end of the world. If you're like me, you hope it is, because it will be the beginning of something beautiful. Just believe me. Don't give up on me.
Hey, world, what you say? Pretty clear to me that our journey is complete, but the mission's just getting started.
Do me a favor and tell me, give me the date, the full date.
It is April 16th, 2013.
So what are your options now?
Really, the only option is short sale, foreclosure, what they call a deed in lieu, where I just basically turn over the keys. But there's no way that it would be a smart move for anyone, whether, you know, me trying to stay in the house or someone who wanted to buy it with a $411,000 note on a property that's worth maybe $225,000, and that was the highest value could find for the place. A lot of the people that are in my situation, including me, I had mortgage insurance on the house, so the company gets paid the mortgage insurance. They get the home back at a higher value, and they turn around and sell it. So they're getting basically paid three times. And there really is no incentive anymore to try to keep people in a home.
Who's out there to help?
There's really no one. Local government doesn't want to do anything, and federal government's falling short too. And those people and companies just, they're crooks. And they just keep making money.
Oh,
don't align with what America is. What are we going to do about it?
United 93, Cleveland.
I don't fully grasp the nature of our time, but as it turned out, I wasn't the only one ready to bust out of my space to find out what the hell was going on. As we traversed the country, we visited OWS encampments in every place we went. The whole thing started off as a group of disenfranchised people, like me, from all walks of life. The movement grew in frenzied proportions, and then it turned ugly. It felt like there was a nationally coordinated government crackdown to disassemble a national movement that had come too close to the truth. As we approached New York City and Zuccotti Park, we were both celebrating our two-month adventure. And wouldn't you know it, for our birthday gift, the NYPD was clearing it out just as we arrived. In the midst of all of the action, we broke away to pay a visit to someone that was directly responsible for this project coming together. His name is Lance Otten, and he was Adam's mentor.
As an American, you are called to build your country, to return back to your country, and to serve others. But all of us have an obligation to row the boat in the same direction to prepare to go out and make the world a better place. Abraham Lincoln was a great American because of the fact that he defined the essential questions of the nation for the citizens to understand. I mean, he was the man who said, a nation divided cannot stand. We've got to put ourselves together, and we've got to be one nation for all people. Franklin Roosevelt talked to the American people about common sense. Eisenhower had the courage as a military general, as president, to say no to going to war in Indochina when the generals and others wanted him to do so. American presidents used to call us to greatness in a way, and perhaps John Kennedy is the best of all. What did John Kennedy say?
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I'll just ask you a very simple question. Can you imagine an American presidential candidate building a campaign around that today? Impossible. The American dream ought to be to provide an opportunity for all people in this country to be as successful as they're capable of being.
Thanks to Lance's influence, this wild chain of cause and effect enabled this opportunity, and that's all I'd been pursuing with my heart and soul for as long as I could remember. When we came to the end of our journey, I came to understand the challenges that not only I face, but that we all face together as a nation. But we didn't understand the possibilities of the future until after Jeremy Rifkin became a beacon of light, clearing a path through the murky darkness.
The souls were left resting as they gathered up the crowd.
Why is there a 1% and a 99%? People have to realize in this country is that this isn't just about a banking system run awry. This is a much bigger issue. This is really the end of an era. We need a new economic game plan for the world that's deliverable, and we have to move quickly in the developing and the developed world to move out of the second industrial revolution into a new third industrial revolution and begin immediately to create millions of jobs, thousands of new businesses, and create a sustainable society for our children and grandchildren. We have to do that now. Pillar one is committed to 20% green energy, renewable energy, distributed energy by 2020. If these renewable energies are distributed and found in every square inch of the world in some proportion, why in heaven's name are we only collecting them in a few central points. This led us to pillar two, buildings. The number one use of energy in our industrial civilization is our buildings, and that creates most of the climate change. Our goal is to convert every one of those 191 million buildings, if we can, to your own personal green micro power plant. Pillar three is a tough pillar. How do we store this energy? The sun isn't always shining. Hydrogen as the main storage carrier for these energies. The simple reason is hydrogen's the basic element of the universe. It's what we're all made out of. It carries other energies. So when the sun, let's say, hits the roof of your house, you have a solar collectors up there. You generate some green electricity. If you have some surplus green electricity you're not using to power your house, you put that electricity in a tank of water. All the hydrogen bubbles out of the tank into a second tank. So when there's cloud cover and there's no solar energy on the roof, you simply convert the hydrogen back to green electricity. A small thermodynamic loss compared to bringing fossil fuels and nuclear power to us. Pillar four is the nervous system for this new infrastructure. This is where the internet communication revolution merges with the new distributed energies to create a nervous system for this new economy. We take off-the-shelf internet technology, and we're going to convert the power grid and the electricity transmission lines to an energy internet. Pillar five is logistics. Electric vehicles are out this year. Fuel cell cars, trucks, and buses are in mass production in 2014. So we'll be able to plug in our vehicles wherever there's a building and get green electricity from the building. Then wherever we travel, there'll be power charging units right under the ground, on the parking meters, everywhere. So we can plug back our vehicles and get green electricity from the grid. Or if the price is right, our software can direct our green electricity to be sold from our vehicle back to the grid. These five pillars together are the infrastructure for a new economic paradigm. They're the mega technology platform that's going to create hundreds of millions of jobs, thousands of new business opportunities, because we have to convert the entire infrastructure of the world. We have to move to renewable energies. That's millions of jobs, thousands of businesses. We have to convert every single building to a power plant, millions of jobs, thousands of businesses. We have to put in storage technology with hydrogen across the infrastructure of every country. We have to set up an energy internet and change the entire electricity and transmission grid, millions of jobs, thousands of businesses. And we have to then take our transport and convert it to electric plug-in and fuel cell transport, millions of jobs. So when people say, how do we grow the economy? They can't grow it on the old infrastructure. The fortunate thing is we now have a new vision, a narrative, and a game plan to move this economy.
The American people are angry.
Close your eyes.
They are angry because they are living through the worst recession since the Great Depression. Unemployment is not 8.2%. Real unemployment is closer to 15%.
And you draw one more day to a close.
There are no jobs.
You choose to be alone. You float through your life as a ghost.
I think we're in a space that we've never, ever, ever been before. And the amount of debt and the amount of unemployment and the amount of inability to get anything done, the fact that everything's so choked, it's not a really great space.
There are workers out there, and I'm sure you know them, Madam President, 50, 55 years old, who intended to work out the remainder of their work lives. Suddenly, they got a pink slip. Their self-esteem is destroyed. They're never going to have another job again, and now they're worried about their retirement security.
And the soldiers' lighthouses on fire, and they burn down.
From about 2006 until now, I've been conflicted between unemployment and retirement. I'm really not sure what I am.
I follow the rules. I went to Cal, got a degree, and now there doesn't seem to be anything for me. What is this American dream about?
This recession was caused by the greed, the recklessness, and the illegal behavior of the people on Wall Street.
They had the biggest amount of profits through the bad time at everybody else's expense, still paying record bonuses. And remember, the banks that got all these foreclosures and took all these toxic assets, well, what's a toxic asset when you write it down to zero? I mean, the banks are bad. And worse than that, they don't even know what they have.
And what these people on Wall Street did is spend billions of dollars, trying to deregulate Wall Street, and they got their way. $5 billion in 10 years is what they spent. And then they were able to merge investment banks with commercial banks, with insurance companies. They got everything they wanted.
Guys are making such mad, crazy money that they don't even know what to spend it on. And there's people that have nothing.
And the end result was that they plunged this country into the worst recession since the Great Depression. 4 years after the financial crisis caused by J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and the other huge financial institutions, one might have thought that perhaps they learned something. But apparently, they have not learned that a lesson. They're back at it again.
I mean, Bear's gone. Lehman's gone. Goldman, B of A, Chase, and Morgan Stanley ought to be gone.
What we need from Wall Street, if we're going to put people back to work, is investments in the productive economy.
The corporations have this huge multi-trillion hoard of cash, while the people that they employ and the citizens of the United States, they go without.
They are angry because they understand that Wall Street received the largest taxpayer bailout in the history of the world. But it was not just the $700 billion that Congress approved through the TARP program. We learned that the Federal Reserve provided a jaw-dropping $16 trillion. If the Fed could provide $16 trillion to large financial institutions, why cannot they begin to move to protect homeowners, unemployed workers, and the middle class of this country? And they are angry not just because unemployment is high. They're not angry. They're angry not just because millions of people have lost their homes and their life savings. They are angry because they understand that the middle class of this country is collapsing, poverty is increasing, while at the same time, the people on top are doing phenomenally well. They, the taxpayers of this country, bail out Wall Street, and Wall Street recovers. Wall Street does well. But now we have kids in this country graduating college, deeply in debt, can't find a job. We have older workers losing their jobs, and people are saying, what is going on in America? And what they are seeing is that this nation is losing its middle class, is losing its democratic values, and in fact is moving toward an oligarchic form of government where a handful of billionaires control the economic and political life of this nation. In the United States today, we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income since the 1920s. What I'm talking about now, you're not going to see it on Fox, you're not going to see it on NBC or CBS, but it's important that we discuss this issue because it is one of the most important issues facing America.
Why are the Kardashians more important than current events, than our democracy?
The wealthiest 400 individuals in America own more wealth than the bottom half of America, 150 million people. 400 and 150 million. And I know we have some of my colleagues coming up here and say, look, not everybody in America is paying taxes. Got millions of people are not paying any taxes. No kidding. They don't have any money because all of the money is on the top.
You know, when it comes to making a mortgage or feeding your family, what are you going to do? You're going to feed your family.
So I have a home and I pay taxes, and my taxes are paying for things that are putting money into billionaires' pockets.
I saw a piece in the paper the other day. It was quite incredible. The rich people apparently leave in America. They're giving up their citizenship. They're going abroad. These great lovers of America who made their money in this country, when you ask them to start paying their fair share of taxes, they're running abroad. We have 19-year-old kids in this country who died in Iraq and Afghanistan defending this country. They went abroad not to escape taxes. They're working-class kids who died in wars, and now the billionaires want to run abroad in order to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. What patriotism. What love.
of country.
Yeah, I saw this as a form of modern-day colonialism. I mean, we were going over there for oil, for resources, for, you know, strategic influence in the area. And, you know, to me, I wasn't going to go risk my life or even worse, take somebody else's life to pad some rich guy's pocket.
And I think what the American people are saying is enough is enough.
There's no one group that is responsible for the system. We could all even blame ourselves for participating. We perpetuate the capitalist system with our buying power. So we need to stop pointing at other people and get to the solution part.
But if you check out and don't fight for what's right, you're just aiding the status quo.
We've got a fight on our hands. The job of the United States Senate is to represent the middle class, working families of this country, all of the people, and not just the super rich. And I hope we can begin to do that.
This American.
I want to have a country where we value every American citizen, where everybody has access to the things that I have access to. It's just basic human decency.
We got a real movement here. We're going to help. We're going to fix this democracy. We're going to heal this economy. But we're going to do it bottom up, and we're not stuck on just one tactic.
We are getting absolutely hammered in this country. And it's because of bad leadership. It's because of the corruption in our system. And because so many people who get in places of power fall into that corruption in order to stay in power.
We have the ability to take it back. But we need to stand up as Americans and choose to do so.
Just look at the numbers. Just look at the macro environment. Look at where the money's going. Look at the situation we're in as far as the depletion of our fossil fuel resources and just the reality of supply and demand. This is where we're going.
I don't make decisions based on government support. But without government support, 95% of American citizens will flounder. It's unacceptable to think that we are going to double down on a system that disenfranchises well over 300 million Americans.
If you run a business and you run it well and you make good decisions and you provide something of value and people want to buy it from you and you make a ton of money doing it, that's what America is supposed to be. That's what capitalism is supposed to be. When you screw up or make a bad decision or provide a bad product or break the rules, you're supposed to go away. That's what capitalism is too.
So we, the people in this country, have been betrayed over and over and over again. But the biggest problem is we don't get out there and do anything about it.
We either support the wealthiest Americans and we give them unfettered power, unfettered access to the federal and state governments, and the ability to ultimately subjugate the rest of America, or we decide that we want to control our own destiny.
Changing the conversation is critical, but it's not enough. Now we've got to be able to go from changing the conversation to changing the conditions under which people are living. And that is a very long, long walk. And you know something about long walks. That is a long walk from changing the conversation to changing the conditions.
I mean, people have to be engaged and they've got to be paying attention to what's going on. And I think that Occupy is a great kind of wake-up call because they're out there and they're doing it. And we have to do that in larger numbers over a sustained amount of time.
We can direct America and we can move forward to an America that values all of us, that enriches all of us, and that educates all of us so that we will have the opportunity to create the America of our dreams.
Travel this entire
Things about that part of it are pretty powerful, but the lead up is mostly about
different song. Here we go.
A dinner between two couples. They're all mostly in academia, and it's a lot of stuff about academia that we all know.
Here we go.
And that kind of slowed it down a little bit. But Alan Cox is in it, and he's great. You may know him as the son of. And I saw a revival of the Rivals.
Stars of Holler If You Hear Me, here to perform a poem from the dead MC Scrolls. Ladies and gentlemen, Saul Williams.
I stand on the corner of the block slinging amethyst rocks, drinking 40s of Mother Earth's private nectar stock, dodging cops. As 5-0 be the 666, and I need a fix of that purple rain type of shit that drives membranes insane. Oh yeah, I'm in the fast lane, snorting candy yams that free my body and soul and send me like Shazam. Never question who I am. God knows, and I know God personally. In fact, he lets me call him me. I be one with rain and stars and things, with dancing feet and watermelon wings. I brings the sunshine and the moon, and the wind blows my tune. Meanwhile, I spoon powder drum beats into plastic bags, selling kilos of Kente skag, taking drags off of collards and cornbread, free bass and two saxophones and flutes like mad. The high notes make me space float. I be exhaling in rings that circle Saturn, leaving stains in my veins and astrological patterns. Yeah, I'm serious, B. Doggone potted. Lovely, but the feds has also plotted me. They're trying to imprison my astrology, put my stars behind bars, my stars in stripes, using blood-splattered banners as nationalist kites. But I control the wind. That's why they call it the Hawkeye. I'm Horus, son of Isis, son of Osiris, worshipped as Jesus, resurrected like Lazarus. But you can call me lazy, lazy. I'm lazy because I'd rather sit and build than work and plow a field, worshipping the daily yield of cash, green crops. Your evolution stopped with the evolution of your technology, a society of automatic tellers and money machines. But what? My culture is lima beans and tambourines. Dreams manifest, dreams real, not consistent with rationale. I dance for no reason, for reason you can't dance. Called it the adaptivist of intellectualized circumstance. You can't learn my steps until you unlearn your thoughts. Spirit soul can't be store-bought thought. It leads to naught, simply state it leads to you trying to figure me out. Your intellect is figuring your soul, your being's not whole. Check your flagpole, stars and stripes. Your astrology's imprisoned by a concept of white or self. What's your plan for spiritual health? Called in reality unreal, your line of thought is tangled. The star spangled got your soul mangled, your being's angled, forbidding you to be real and feel. You can't find truth as an act or a Jill in a White House on the hill or in factories or plants made of steel. Stealing us was the smartest thing you ever did. Too bad you don't teach the truth to your kids. My influence on you is a reflection you see when you look into your menstrual mirror and talk about your culture. Your existence is that of a schizophrenic vulture who thinks he has enough life in him to prey on the dead, not realizing that the dead ain't dead, that he ain't got enough spirituality. Dreams manifest, dreams real, not consistent with rationale. I dance for no reason, for reason you can't dance. Called it the adaptivist of intellectualized circumstance. You can't learn my steps until you unlearn your thoughts. Spirit soul can't be store-bought thought. It leads to naught, simply state it leads to you trying to figure me out. Your intellect is figuring your soul, your being's not whole. Check your flagpole, stars and stripes. Your astrology's imprisoned by a concept of white or self. What's your plan for spiritual health? Called in reality unreal, your line of thought is tangled. The star spangled got your soul mangled, your being's angled, forbidding you to be real and feel. You can't find truth as an act or a Jill in a White House on the hill or in factories or plants made of steel. Stealing us was the smartest thing you ever did. Too bad you don't teach the truth to your kids. My influence on you is a reflection you see when you look into your menstrual mirror and talk about your culture. Your existence is that of a schizophrenic vulture who thinks he has enough life in him to prey on the dead, not realizing that the dead ain't dead, that he ain't got enough spirituality to know how to pray. Yeah, it's no repentance. You're about to live an infinite consecutive executive life sentence. So while you're out busy serving time, I'll be in sync with the moon while you run from the sun. Life of the womb reflected by guns. Worship of moons, I am the sun, and I am public enemy number one. One.
Saul Williams, Holler If You Hear Me on Broadway. momentary lapse of reason? How did progress take priority over humankind? How could the desire for a modern way of life that threatens our future be considered a way of life? Could it be we are connected to all things in the universe, not the center of it? That suburbs in Los Angeles affect the melting ice caps of Antarctica. Deforestation in the Congo affects the typhoons of Japan. Now we must face the insurmountable challenges for what they really are. Opportunities to reinvent and redesign. E squared, the economies of being environmentally conscious.
Architecture is the art of telling stories. If you are a writer, you tell a story by writing. If you are a poet, by making poems. If you are an architect, you tell a story by building buildings. But each building has a different story to tell. If you make art museum, it's about contemplation of art, it's about light. If you make an auditorium, it's about music. A science museum, a natural science museum, tells a story about energy, about love, about exploration, about wonder, about discovery. So this is a very interesting story to tell.
On 9 acres in the heart of San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, renowned architect Renzo Piano is creating a new home for the California Academy of Sciences. When complete, the new building will be one of the greenest museums in the world.
Well, the California Academy of Sciences was established back in 1853. Early on, sort of an environmental ethic was part of the Academy's founding and really ran through the history of the organization. This project, like a lot of others in the city, really has its roots in the San Francisco earthquake of 89. The buildings got shook up a little bit. One building had to be closed to the public. Dinehart Aquarium was shaken up and really exposed some of its deficiencies. And that led us to say, let's step back and ask ourselves just a simple question. What's a natural history museum in the 21st century? How do you take that sort of Victorian-era concept and make it relevant to people today?
In some ways, you can think of the mission of a modern museum in two ways. On the one hand, our mission is explore, explain, protect the natural world. That's what our mission is at its core. But it begins with us being an attraction. If we don't get people to come visit us, we don't achieve our mission. So it's a delicate balance a modern museum has to strike. But if a modern museum doesn't do both, it will cease to exist. It's as simple as that.
We decided that the architecture of the new building should be a statement. We didn't know what the statement was, but we thought that it should be part of the aspirations for the project. It should involve a great design. This is a complex project. Look, we've got an aquarium. It's a natural history museum, 20 million specimens. Who can do a project like that?
To create an iconic, deeply relevant building, the Academy hosted an international design competition. After inviting 40 architecture firms known for bold, innovative designs, they interviewed 6 finalists. One of them was Renzo Piano.
When this idea came that we may be designing a science museum in San Francisco, I came really not because I thought we can necessarily do it, but to show a kind of open interest in nature.
When Renzo came for the interview, it was in the old Academy, and the boardroom was a very formal room with a lectern and a screen and these chairs. We showed Renzo the room and said, Renzo, get yourself organized. And shortly thereafter, he motioned us that he was ready, and we walked in the room, and the room had been changed around. And he had taken these chairs that were facing forward and had put them in a big circle, and then he pulled a table from one of the corners and put that in the middle. He said, you know, I talked to you about some of my projects. Happy to do that again if you like, but I would really like to hear from you all. What are your aspirations for the Academy? What do you want?
It's a little too dark. It needs to be brighter and have a little...
I got to hear board members speak about the Academy with passion and aspirations that I never heard them speak before. At the end of that exercise, he said, you know, I couldn't even begin to design a building for you. But as you are talking, I'm understanding the interplay between sort of nature and science and so forth. And he made me a little sketch.
He's won a lot of competitions because what I think the clients pick up from him is that he listens. And they realize that this is somebody who's not going to give them something he wants to deliver, but lets the problem tell him what to do. Renzo Piano is the architect who's laying the foundations for the future. At the end of the modern period, cities got very much fragmented. The relationship between buildings and nature became very destructive. It's Piano who is attempting to heal that, trying to reestablish a relationship with nature in his architecture.
I was born and grew up in a family of builders. And in fact, when I went to see my father, he told me, but why ever you want to be an architect, you can be a builder. It's like a little god. Why ever you want to be an architect? I didn't answer because I didn't know. Then I found that it was not a bad idea to become an architect. But I kept in my heart the idea that architecture is very much about building. It's not just building, of course. It's about understanding, it's about art, it's about history, it's about so many things. So my work has been, from the beginning, kind of meeting point between sociology, art in some way, and construction.
Of the architects working on a global spectrum, I think he's the only one in some ways who you could say is both global and local. It's not just another Piano building, it's a building that seems to grow out of the context that belongs to its place and the larger cultural forces around.
A signature aspect of Piano's work is what architects call transparency. Spacious and inclusive, his buildings strive to perfectly blend the viewer, the structure, and their natural surroundings.
Transparency is an essential element to create that sense of participation, enjoyment. It's not a building made of stone. It's not a building made of massive, aggressive volumes. It's more about a friendly, welcoming approach.
This dimension of transparency is important for Piano. He likes you to be able to see through buildings. He likes buildings that don't seem to sit heavily on the ground. But he means other things also, because transparency we also use in the term of somebody's a transparent character. You can see him, he's honest. So he likes to reveal how things are made. You see how they're assembled. You see which bits are working. So he means transparency in a somewhat expanded sense from most people.
A lot of Renzo's buildings are referred to as being biomorphic. Think of a skeleton of any dinosaur, if you will, and that wonderful structure. Everything you need, but no more. If you think of some of the other major iconic buildings that you see today, they're highly exuberant with all kinds of stuff. Renzo's are not.
But probably more important for the Academy was the idea that we really wanted to create some transparency about who we are and what we do. Most people know the Academy by the Steinhardt Aquarium or the Morrison Planetarium or the Kimball Museum of Natural History.
and less about the science that happens there. And so we really wanted to bring that side of the academy into play.
We kept making discussion about those two realities being together. Research people there, making research, and people enjoying science. I wanted to do this job because I love it, the idea to make a museum about natural science. People should never forget that this institution was created by a sailboat going around the world, collecting species and coming back to the harbor. I love science. It's not the only thing I love. I love art. I love painting. I love so many things. But nature is kind of a soup in which we swim from the beginning.
I think from the get-go, it was very much a need of the Academy to find an architect that they felt they could develop a partnership with, and also somebody who was prepared to take on the challenge of developing as green a building as can be developed.
It was part of the Academy's mission, once they decided to do a new building, to have it be the most sustainable building possible. And that really is a natural extension of their mission and their role.
When we said we wanted to have a green building, we didn't know what that really meant. But we wanted to work together to try to figure out what that could be in this building, in a building about science and nature.
It was clear that the location was magic. To be in the center of Golden Gate Park in San Francisco is a great asset. Actually, the previous building, they were not taking the opportunity of sitting in the middle of the park. They were quite close to the park. So we immediately understood that the big challenge was to make a new building that was part of the park. The building is actually made like a coming in peaceful park and lifting up. Actually, if you fly above the building, you don't even see the building. The building belonged to the park, and the park belonged to the building.
A 2.5-acre living roof seamlessly blends structure with nature, both visually and functionally. The roof's 1.7 million plant species at insulation require no irrigation and make up the largest patch of native California plants in San Francisco.
This roof is actually an exhibit in and of itself. It's a very different kind of exhibit than is normally presented in a natural history museum. It's not static. It will constantly be changing. And that philosophy really permeates a lot of the exhibits. The Academy is not presenting just proven facts and history. They're presenting hypotheses. What if we create an ecosystem in the park? Could we bring back an endangered species? Let's see what happens.
Yeah, it's been an experiment in the making, and a lot of research and a lot of time has gone into figuring out what will hopefully work the best up here on its own.
Cooper was involved for a number of years in trying different kinds of plants to figure out what was going to work, what was most suitable for the environment.
And a lot of this is just trying to replicate what's naturally happening in the environment around us. A lot of these slopes, these domes, are much like the hills all around San Francisco. And on those hills you find these plants. So it kind of makes sense to put them here, and hopefully they'll do the same thing that they do out there.
I like to think of it as a link in the ecological corridor that is Golden Gate Park. We've created 2.5 acres of native California plant species. We've given 2.5 acres back to the park. This isn't just a green roof, it's really a living roof. It's more like a skin. Think of it as a membrane that is regulating the metabolism of the building and providing essential functions. The skylights that you see here, those are providing essential light for both the rainforest as well as the aquaria below. It's capturing stormwater. We're avoiding almost 3 million gallons a year of stormwater going to the wastewater treatment plants in San Francisco. It has insulating properties so that the temperature below the roof is 10 degrees cooler than the temperature on the roof. And why this is really a living roof is because it's a source of energy. There's a ring around the perimeter of the roof, and within that are photovoltaic cells that are providing 5% of the building's energy needs. Most green roofs do not also supply energy, and this one is very, very unique in that regard.
It's not just belonging to park, it's belonging to nature. It's belonging to the new idea that the world is fragile and the ecology is an essential moral duty.
Striving for a fully coherent experience, the designers carefully planned exhibits that would flow into and merge with the structure and surroundings.
The wonderful thing about working with Renzo and his team is that they, if you will, gave us this remarkable building, but it didn't end there. They wanted to make sure that our exhibits and programs worked within it. How would our exhibits exist in the space and yet not be overpowered and be, if you will, be more prominent in the space?
This building is a bit like a machine. It is a machine, but taken to a limit where it looks almost like nature. So when you go around the building and you look through the planetarium, that is another machine, the rainforest, that is in some way another machine, you look at the planting on the roof, you realize that this is a machine, but it's a biological machine.
The museum used to be, as it were, a planetarium, an aquarium, and a museum. We still are, in essence, those three components, but now they're interconnected in a way that the stories and the messages are interwoven. But the whole thing is a network, like a spider's web, and as soon as you start messing with one part of the spider's web, the rest of the web starts to shudder and have impacts and feels change. That's the natural world.
The web of life is most densely interwoven in a rainforest. And museum visitors can become part of a 65-foot-tall living exhibit without leaving San Francisco.
I guess everybody working in a museum have their favorite exhibit, you know, before it opens. My current favorite is the rainforest exhibit. I've been fortunate enough to visit a number of rainforests around the world, and they're magical, magical places. What we're creating here is something that will get close to being in a real rainforest. So you'll walk into a 65-foot-tall glass bubble, and you'll ascend up through a full-height neotropical rainforest with free-flying birds and butterflies, and then you'll get to the top of the dome, and you'll jump in a glass elevator, and you'll descend back through the exhibit. Nowhere in the world, as far as I'm aware, puts all that in one place.
A rainforest in San Francisco? We need to take that on from a sustainability point of view as well. So the design of the rainforest, the design of the skylights is this difficult Rubik's Cube of trying to get light in there and yet not so much light that we have to air condition the building. So it's a really interesting conundrum that the architects and engineers and the exhibit designers had to work with. But I think it really is going to transform the way that people look at natural history museums.
The remodeled Steinhardt Aquarium, where 38,000 animals live in circulating natural seawater, is more an extension of the ocean than an exhibit. The second largest live reef display in the world, it's designed to engage visitors physically and emotionally.
The new Steinhardt in many ways will be familiar to the old, because the old Steinhardt had a history of displaying this immense range of biodiversity. What we've done with the new Steinhardt is we've tried to pick exhibits that are meaningful for people, that really grab their attention, draw them in, and then we can encourage them to get involved and make a difference regarding conservation.
saltwater for the aquarium is being piped in from the Pacific Ocean. There's a long pipeline that runs through the length of Golden Gate Park to the California Academy of Sciences. It's actually powered by a windmill that you can see down at Ocean Beach.
We use real natural seawater because it's the best you can get. But because we recycle the water much more than we used to, we have twice the volume of water, but we're using the same amount or less water than we used in the old academy. Coral reefs are one of those spectacular natural habitats that so few people actually get to see up close. And so I think it's very important that we allow other people to be able to see them. And of course, reefs are severely endangered.
The trip over this morning, we boxed up some of the corals, and then we got them over here, we acclimated them for a little while, and we put them into the tanks.
This tank is a Philippine coral reef tank. It's the largest display that we have here in our new facility. There's more than 200,000 gallons of seawater that I'm floating around in right now. I think probably the greatest threats that coral reefs are facing in the wild are all due to the activities of humans. There's destructive fishing, there's coastal development, agriculture. Climate change brings another stressor. The amalgamation of those stressors is usually what begins to wipe coral reefs out. The vast majority of the people that come through our doors and see this coral reef tank will never have the opportunity to travel to the Philippines and dive on an actual coral reef. But when they come in and they look through this window and they see thousands of fish and all of the living coral, it plants that information, that little spark of excitement in their life, that then they can connect with all of the stories that people are telling in the news about destruction and the need for habitat preservation.
Defying expectations, the completed California Academy of Sciences building will dissolve the separation between viewer and exhibit. This vibrant, comprehensive design is redefining what a museum can be.
What we wanted to do with the experience here is sort of create the experience of the unmuseum. So you want people to come into a building and sort of go, this can't be a museum. You know, it's too bright, it's too light, it's a big open space. So I think the building and its transparency and its sustainable design and the very essence of what it is challenged us to create the unmuseum and do a group of exhibits that utilize those strengths but also reinvented the museum experience.
I think the Academy today serves as an educational model, and it says you can do this. And you know what? It's not just in the initial design. It's not just in the construction, but it's also in the operations of the building and how the users will maintain and operate that building for the next 100 years.
I guess there are two things I'd like people to take away from the new academy. The first of those is that snakes are cool and they're not always dangerous, and we should all love snakes. That would be my personal message. But a second and arguably more important message is that we can all make a difference in our way of life and how it impacts the people around us and how it impacts the planet.
Nature is very interesting for everybody, but it's especially interesting to young people. And children have a kind of natural interest. You know, I have myself a little child, he's 8 years old. And at that age, you discover the world. And when you put in those little minds curiosity about nature, well, you create a new generation of people with that feeling that the world is fragile.
For more information about E2, visit our website at e2-series.com.
pie.
Studies is it for the children?
Which our ancestors lived for hundreds of thousands of years. Women probably have 4 to 6 children in a lifetime. Half those children would die before they could reproduce. So the only thing we can be sure about in human population studies is that for the last 100,000 years, people on average had 2 children to succeed them, or there would have been a population explosion 1,000 years ago.
In just the last nanosecond of human history, which began 10,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture, we began to change the way we looked at the earth, something that we separated ourselves from. It is the basis for our civilization today.
Spread notions of proper sanitation, as we've vaccinated for diseases, as we've provided famine relief and basic levels of health care, we see an unintended consequence of our best intentions.
By adding fossil fuels to our agriculture, we have allowed populations to simply skyrocket.
Million babies will come into the world this year. The rate increases. More babies mean finally still more babies. When these have reached the age of 40, the world will have doubled its numbers. Helpless, harmless infants.
In the 1960s, population was growing at an unprecedented rate, the highest in human history, as famine developed in South Asia, spreading fear to the rest of the planet.
These are harsh words. They serve to describe the coming crisis in population and food supply that's aptly called the population explosion.
I started talking about the population issue because it hadn't been discussed. People had not made the connection between what was happening to the environment and the fact that our population was growing like a skyrocket. And that's where the population bomb came from. Ann and I wrote it in about 5 weeks of evenings. It was a political track, basically.
The world started grasping the urgency of the situation. Advocacy groups such as Zero Population Growth emerged in the U.S. in the 1960s. For the first time, population growth was linked as a major factor responsible for the global environmental crisis at the first Earth Day in 1970.
Meat.
What you
garbage. You know, it's like that's the main thing, in my opinion.
Oh, people.
Oh, people.
Number of people. Okay, that's true.
People, yeah.
40 years later, the environmental message has not changed. Apart from a few persistent groups, population growth is barely being mentioned. It's as if the issue has been diluted among all others, even though population growth and human consumption are the major factors in our ongoing environmental crisis.
How many people were on the planet first Earth Day?
About 1 billion.
Yeah. Maybe over a billion?
Yeah.
What do you think the population of the planet is today?
A lot.
It was 3.7 billion in 1970, okay. And now it's 6.8 billion.
Mm. Yeah. The problem is not that we haven't had an environmental movement, and that not that some effective things haven't been done. It's a big cultural change, but not fast enough.
Since the first Earth Day, we've had a fivefold increase in recycling, yet we're producing more trash than we did in 1970.
We are seeing today the sixth mass extinction of species in Earth's history. It is the only one caused by one species, and we're it.
The human species is quite unique in the sense that our consumption pattern is not just given by our appetite. An elephant has a similar consumption pattern no matter what. But people, they can decide not only how to eat, but also how big their houses are and how much else they consume, how many clothes they have, etc. So there's no inherent limit to consumption for an individual. We have a compound problem of rapidly growing populations at the same time as our demand for resources is increasing, but the size of the planet is not. Now we are at global overshoot. Our demand is larger than what nature can regenerate.
And there's no need to think about anything like limits because we've never had to encounter them. We see ourselves as this tiny pimple on a pumpkin or something.
Our world population dynamic today is much different than in 1970. Although it is growing at a much lower rate, it is more than ever at the center of our global crisis. We are adding about 50 million new middle class each year, modeling their consumption habits from the unsustainable lifestyle of the developed world. A triumph for progress and poverty, but a ticking bomb for our civilization. The world is already giving us warnings and clues about the looming global crises that we can't afford to ignore.
Agriculture has always been susceptible to supply side shocks caused by climatic conditions. We're seeing a different situation now. The demand for agricultural crops is on a strong upward trend.
The demand for food now driven by three forces. One is population growth. The second is rising affluence. 2 or 3 billion people trying to move up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive livestock products, and the conversion of grain into fuel for cars. The grain required to fill a 25-gallon SUV tank with ethanol would feed one person for a year. The big issue is going to be water. We see in some countries now where farmers are using virtually all the technologies available to raise yields. The market realizes that things are tightening up. As one observer said, land has become the new gold.
Rising food prices combined with rising unemployment have sparked riots and political unrest.
Every year, there are about 78 million more people living on the planet. That's about 220,000 people every day, competing for both natural resources and for economic opportunities, stretching further the capacity of the world to sustain us. More than half of the world population, the majority in the developing world, is under the age of 28, and is either at or will be at a reproductive age in the next few years. Depending on the kind of choices these youth will take, humanity, according to the UN projections, could be as low as 8 billion or as high as 10.5 billion by 2050. A variance that could make all the difference, as we are beginning to reach many thresholds on the planet.
Population doesn't turn around on a dime. Population is continuing to grow. There's a momentum in population today. Even if all the couples in the world were to decide today that they were not going to have more than two children, it's estimated that world population would continue to grow to about 8 billion. That momentum means that we have got to, under almost any circumstances, continue to find ways to feed that many people.
I think when I grew up and, you know, met JP, who's my husband, and we were going to have kids, and we had our first child, and that was great, a little boy. And we had our second child, a little girl, and that was great. And then I kind of thought, you know, I was kind of imagining we'd have more, but then we had talked about it. JP is from a small family of two, and he said he really believed in the replacement, that we wouldn't expand the population, that it was a really big belief of his. And I could fully get behind that and understand that intellectually, but there was a feeling in me that was like, you don't really have a family if you can't, you know, have a baseball team at any given moment. So I wanted to have a bigger family, and JP is a very kind of a rare, willing mate, in that he was up for that too. Adoption seemed like a great way for our family to grow in a way that didn't impact population. So we adopted our youngest daughter, Lato, from South Africa. And I have to say, it feels better to me to have three kids. Like, two felt kind of puny to me. Didn't feel like enough. So I was approached by the producer of this film to be involved because of the work that I'd been doing with children's rights. With some friends, I co-founded Mothers Acting Up, which is a movement that invites mothers to see themselves as advocates for the world's children. I was intrigued to learn more about how this issue was impacting children's issues and women's issues.
Population explosion has immediate dangers for us and for our children.
You know, when this issue first burst on into public consciousness, you know, population was growing incredibly rapidly. People were making really dire predictions. The world responded. Things changed. A lot more women got access to contraceptives. Population growth rates came down pretty dramatically all over the world. And so people said, well, that problem is largely solved.
For the last few years, the UN has been revising its predictions upwards in both developing and developed nations.
If we now assume the problem is solved and fail to pay adequate attention to it, we're going to see it, all of that work undermined.
Over the past few decades, the debate about population has been pushed to the side. One reason is the ongoing stigmatization of the issue, mainly coming from human rights abuses by several countries that have used forced sterilizations and other coercive means to lower their growth rate. The topic of population is also a victim of its own success. The growth rate of the world has been nearly cut in half over the past 50 years. The developed world, primarily Europe and Japan, have seen their decreasing numbers and the aging of their population as a threat to their prosperity.
In many countries, they are paying people what I call bribes to have babies, thinking that if they get the birth rate up, they'll have more working adults to help support the aged population. Having babies on top of an aging population that is relatively healthy and can work much longer years than the standard retirement age that was set during the time of Bismarck is a crazy way to try to solve that problem.
If you
increase the retirement age by a couple of years, by just about 2 years or 2.5 years. This actually covers the costs of the old people.
While the population issue is being raised among some governmental entities and NGOs, it is still a taboo subject within societies.
For people who are concerned about being on the right side of the society's view of an issue, the dominant message has been population's over with, don't talk about it, it's really taboo. Even those concerned people who are sitting in traffic jams saying, I know there's a problem, have been afraid to speak out. And it's really a reflection of people's fear of being out of line with what is socially acceptable.
My mom and my dad, you know, just got married right at the end of World War II. My mom was a good Catholic. My dad was a Protestant who converted over to Catholicism. There was a time where my oldest brother was 4 years old, and he fell into a pond through the ice in upstate New York. And my mom, at that point, prayed to God, and she said, if Mike lives, I promise I won't do the one sin that I'm doing, which is birth control, that she was planning on doing. My brother Mike lived. So my mom said she wasn't going to use birth control. So you end up with 10 kids. And that's what happens when you have this happy, loving relationship and no birth control. There's this feeling of plenty, like you were in the center of the universe when you were at home with the whole family. Like it was a really good feeling of a lot of plenty of enough.
What is the third most populous country after India and China?
Brazil.
Indonesia.
We found a friend.
Here, the U.S.
Right now, it's the third most populous country. Third most populous country.
Although the U.S. isn't the fastest-growing country, with only about 1% growth, it is the highest in the industrialized world. After including net migration, the U.S. grows by about 2.7 million people each year. But the problem goes beyond these numbers.
If everybody worldwide lived American lifestyles today, it would take about close to 6 planets like Earth to regenerate all the resources we consume in the United States and to absorb the according waste. And that would be entire planets, leaving nothing for other species. It's a model that is not globally replicable. Of course, some areas can use more than what their areas can regenerate because of trade, but not all countries can replicate this model of being net importers of ecological services. Just physically, mathematically, doesn't add up.
We've got to set an example and stop our own population growth if we're going to have any moral basis for lecturing to people in other countries and say, you've got to stop your population growth.
The rich countries, broadly wrought, pointing to the poor countries and saying, the problem is population growth. You should get your populations under control. The poor countries saying, no, the problem is inequity, and you should get your overconsumption under control. So here this kind of fight goes on. The solution we have is, okay, grow like us. We have fetishized, we have worshipped, we have created an ideology out of growth that has now taken over our economic planning and development.
Our economy has grown highly dependent on people, or more precisely, on consumers. It always needs more to sustain its endless appetite for growth, and always manages to find more of us. We became its lifeblood.
The people who are promoting growth are the people who make the profits from it. You know, the one thing that people don't understand, and the developers like to hide, is that the growth never pays for itself. Your taxes have to go up to pay the cost of this growth.
Research has shown that sprawl ends up costing more money than it will ever bring in. You know, you need more police and more parks and more fire departments and more schools and expanding the sewer system, another water treatment plant probably, more everything.
If the growth was paying for itself, there'd be money in the bank to pay for a downturn in the economy, to keep the state government going, but that hasn't happened. Everyone, the cities, the states, are all turning to the federal government to get money from the feds because the federal people don't have any responsible limit on the appropriations and on their budgets. And so what we're having then is essentially a Ponzi scheme in which you have people contributing every year, which goes to the benefit of few people, but it means that the taxes have to go up for everybody.
Any economic system that demands endless growth is bound to collapse.
Learned about the population issue, I felt like I wanted to go to a place on our earth where it's really a top issue. I was given the opportunity to go back to Africa with the film. On children's rights issues. And the impact on children is enormous. Like, with that many children being born, how are their basic needs going to be met? Just walking out in the streets of Addis, and I stopped to give one woman who was begging a one burr note, which is, you know, worth, I don't know, not even 10 cents. And then more people started to come because they saw that I was giving money in maybe larger increments than usual. And I just got surrounded by so many people who needed money and to just eat, to feed their babies here on their backs. And you start to feel the impact of overpopulation, that there are so many people spilling into the urban centers to just get what they need to live and to feed their children.
The major problems, social, economic, developmental problems in Ethiopia is rapid population growth. Rapid population growth in this country has driven the population to abject poverty.
It is difficult or impossible to achieve economic development as long as birth rates are very high in the least developed countries. Education and health cannot keep up, and poverty goes right along with this.
You look at some of the poorest countries in the world, already incapable of meeting the most basic needs of their citizens. And they're scheduled to double, population-wise, in the next 30 to 40 years. They just can't keep up. This rapid population growth is certainly linked to political instability, resource competition, the global food crisis.
If you think that this is an isolated problem, and it's only Africa's problem, think again.
The American housewife. Who has a more important, a more responsible occupation? Wife, mother, laundress, counselor, maid, chef, purchasing agent. All of these are her duties at one time or another.
When you think back to the 50s, the expectation was that a woman would stay home, run a household, raise the children, and her husband would go off and work and bring home the bacon. Money.
the pill.
I see. Well,
the introduction of the pill in the 1960s was huge. Women could choose the timing and the number of births. You had the means and the opportunity to delay childbearing indefinitely. And many of us did. There is still a lot of societal pressure to have children. When you say, I'm child-free by choice, there is an assumption that you are that way because you hate children or you're heartless or cold, or there is an assumption that something is seriously wrong, not just physically, but mentally or emotionally. When I talk to people about their birth control methods, most of them told me they had sought permanent sterilization. And this is very, very tough for women, particularly younger women in their 20s and 30s that are seeking tubal ligations. Many doctors will say, well, ask you to undergo a year of counseling at your own expense before they give you a tubal ligation, or they'll just flat out refuse your request for one. Often it is, you're too young, you haven't had any children yet, you're likely to change your mind. No one challenges a young woman who says, I want to have three children. If you say, I don't want to have any children, you will be challenged in the medical community and in the mental health community.
We live in a sex-soaked society, but we don't really like to talk about sex. We certainly don't want our children to hear about sex. Even though sex sells all our products, sex is all over TV, sex is what everybody loves in the movies, so it's a weird dichotomy.
Well, in the United States, remember that 40% of pregnancies are unintended. Our teenagers have the highest birth rate in the developed world, and yet we make it very hard for them to get family planning in many states. So if we really are the population problem, we should be looking at reducing the number of unintended pregnancies by making it easier to get family planning in the United States. It is not widely known that there are a very large number of barriers standing between women and the means and the information to contraception that they need in order to manage their childbearing. In almost all countries, the desired family size is lower than the actual family size in huge surveys, the demographic and health surveys.
According to published studies, it is estimated that 215 million women worldwide who wish to have smaller families don't use modern family planning, largely because of informational and cultural barriers. Many of these women don't want or intend to use it because they have heard it is dangerous. Male partners are opposed, their religion is opposed, or they are leaving decisions on the number of children up to God. According to the UNFPA, if those women met their needs, it would reduce population growth by 28%, and at the same time, would save lives and advance human rights.
For anybody who thinks that poor people want large families in Africa, for example, then they'd better look again and notice that Africa has an enormous number of abortions every year, and a lot of those are unsafe, and a lot of those do a lot of damage.
We are losing every year about 350,000 women from maternal death. 13% of those women die because of unsafe abortion. So that's the mathematic. I mean, the numbers are out there.
There's so many women who are raped worldwide and have children who are then often really not cared for. The issue isn't abortion. The issue is preventing the need for so many abortions.
I wanted to meet the people. You know, not just read about it in a book, but really meet people and see what they're doing to figure out solutions. That's where I found out about the Population Media Center, and they are using entertainment to get out social messages about population.
To every program.
The Population Media Center specializes in the production of long-running serialized dramas on radio or television, also known as soap operas or telenovelas, where characters evolve into role models for the audience gradually over time. I think what makes Population Media Center's work so unique is the fact that it connects with the audience at an emotional level. We're not just building cognitive information, because so many of our decisions are based on emotion, not actually the information that we have. By creating scenes that the audience can relate to and characters that the audience sees themselves in, we're able to convey a message and also allow them to really understand how they too can take the actions that the characters have taken in their lives and apply it to their own.
Do you usually listen when you're doing other things or when you're traveling? Or do you
I was invited to a focus group of the radio dramas. All the women there had amazing stories to tell about how these characters had served as role models for them so that they could be strong and start to change some of the practices that kept the women down in their villages.
Many of these stories are about just personal stories where they had to beg for help to, you know, they, my dad wanted my mom to be tested to see if she was pregnant. I don't want to back it up. Let's see if I can finish this here. Then my father believed that the pill works. My sister died of AIDS when her baby was 3 months old. Her death affected me a lot. My niece is 5 now, and she takes medicine every day because she had AIDS. Yeah. We have been through a lot. But we are still here today. She's crying now. It's hard. Yeah.
Women are basically viewed as they are in very rigid domination systems as technologies of reproduction. In some of the poorest and most rigidly male-dominated cultures, and they go together, women have no status whatsoever unless they produce a son. The girl in a poor country, especially the poorest girls, they eat last, they eat least, they get up earliest, they go to bed latest, they do the most work, and they have the least say over what happens in their life.
Women are, in many poor countries, considered property of the man. And in some countries, they have slightly lower status than the cattle. When women are sold into marriage at age 9 or 10, and they become pregnant as soon as they're fertile, they don't have the right or the ability to make decisions about family life or family planning on their own.
70% of those living in absolute poverty worldwide are female. There is no way in a humane, non-authoritarian, caring way to change this overbreeding without raising the status of women worldwide.
After the focus group, I was so moved by Zenit's story and all the hurdles that she has encountered and how she's overcome so many as just a young woman. So I asked if we could go and visit her and her family and in the village. You know, looking at her family and meeting her mother and her father, and the first thing that struck me was how much older the dad was than the mother. And then I later learned that she was 12 years old when she married him, and he was like 45. Zenit's father had another family before this one where he had 13 children with another wife. And this is a typical, you know, scenario in Ethiopia. They were stuck in these societal roles that have been handed down to them.
Translate. I gotta put myself in the different places. He regretted a lot that he had tried to force arranged marriages on his daughters. My father said that as he forced me to marry, I would have ended up being a house servant and having a lot of kids. Now he really regrets it.
She also is like a surrogate mother for her niece. 6 years ago, Zenit's younger sister died of AIDS when this little niece was only 3 months old. So now the niece has AIDS as well and is living with it. Wasila, we wanted to ask you a question. What do you think about Zenit and what do you want to be when you grow up?
Wasila, Wasila Zenit, what do you want to be?
I don't want Zena to die. I want her to live. I love her.
What do you want to do when you grow up?
She wants to be a doctor.
A doctor? Fantastic. That's great. This is just one child who's symptomatic of a larger problem that we have all throughout Ethiopia and throughout Africa. Zenit goes to school on the weekends in a university that's near her town, and then during the day she works all day supporting the family at a family planning clinic. And then when she comes home at night, she helps with the family, she helps with chores, and then she has to study at night.
ድራማውን በማዳመጤ My life was so hard. You gave me strength.
I named my daughter after.
So far, from the beginning of our radio serial drama, we have received more than 30,000 letters from all over the country. Based on the final evaluation, we have discovered that, demand for contraceptives increased 157%. That was really amazing. Spousal communication had also increased from 33% to 68%.
And that often leads to the decision for the woman or the man to seek family planning. Often women think their husbands are opposed when they're not, but they've never asked them.
Meeting Zenith, getting to go to her home, and, kind of got to know each other, even though it was quick. I feel like she's my new hero. She has overcome enormous obstacles and has met challenges face on. She's taken cultural traditions in her village that have been lasting over a millennium and has said, no, I want better for myself and for my siblings and for all the women in my community. It doesn't stop just with her. She works so much within her community to get other women to be listening to the radio dramas so that they too can get that role modeling, so that they can feel that courage and that power within themselves. I'm going to think of her when I need more strength to think one person can make a difference.
Let me see what's going on here. When born, each of us has a plan for their future. In order to fulfill our dreams, we have to have patience.
Everyone should have the right to reproduce. It's a fundamental, basic human right. The course of population stability is going to come from millions of women just like Zenit making these same choices. They need an education. They need some outside agent that's going to help them empower themselves. And they need a voice.
The poor girl doesn't have options unless there's some kind of intervention. And what BRAC tries to do with girls is invest in them. Invest in giving them options and opportunities and education, because a girl who's educated will marry later, will have fewer children, her children will survive and be healthier, and they'll all have a better life. In fact, that's what we call the girl effect. The majority of the whole banking system is catering to men. Less than 1% of loans from our formal financial institutions would actually flow to women. So what happened is people discovered that women are better fighters of poverty, that 100% of what a poor woman will earn gets put right back into the mouths of her kids, into improved health care, into a better roof over the family, invest in getting those kids into school. Microfinance, it's a strategy that has poor women's fingerprints all over it. Women who never touched money before suddenly have new forms of power and status in their household. That enables them to negotiate the relationship they have with their husbands, with their fathers, with their sons, with their community member. It's brought hope to millions of women, and they're not only improving their own lives and those of their family, what they're contributing to society.
So from an economic prospect, in the prospect of fighting poverty, it's only natural that we empower women. I mean, it's just common sense. And it's difficult to not understand why we are not still getting it. Why we are still keeping half of the population in a situation where it cannot contribute to the wealth, of the country and to the wealth of the world.
I'm hoping that one day we would have more women who would have opportunities to go to school, to learn how to read and write, to learn their rights, not even from Western ideologies. Within their culture, within their religion, they have rights, but they don't know. And we don't have to go far to start teaching them these things. We can start right from within the culture and then go the next steps.
You can't liberate the women without changing the men, or you will just end up with a lot of beaten women. So changing men's minds about the humanity of women is critically important.
Start talking about that vexing thing called gender. You know, people feel uncomfortable talking about it. But as the great sociologist Lewis Wirth said, the most important things about a society are those that people feel uncomfortable talking about. We saw that about race, and we certainly see it about gender.
Before I went to Ethiopia, I intellectually understood your GP's position about having a smaller biological family. But now, I feel like I really get it, about how population is the thing putting all this pressure on your children's rights and on our planet. I think it's interesting that I'm the one being in this population film. My brothers and sisters have gone on to have many children. Their children are now having children. A lot of people have advanced degrees. You know, we have a surgeon, lawyers, doctors. But it's still just an issue of numbers. You know, each person has a car. Each person has to have a home. The impact is huge. And I realized that it starts with people like me and like JP just sitting down together at the beginning of our families and saying, our planet's limits have changed. How are we going to change how we make a family?
What does it take for humanity to live within the means of one planet? We haven't found the silver bullet yet. But essentially, you start to look at all these five factors: population, consumption, efficiency, productivity of ecosystems, etc., to see how we can match them all to get us back within the capacity of one planet, and possibly even below that line, because some space we want to leave for wild species, because they too need food.
We're going to need a different compass than growth as it is currently measured. We want to grow in wisdom. We want to grow in knowledge. We want to grow in just plain smart, figuring out how to live well and take care of each other on this planet.
There's many opportunities now for developing countries to be able to leapfrog over the traditional path of development, the way that we got rich in the U.S. or in Europe. In every poor community, you're going to find these kinds of social entrepreneurs that are figuring out a different way to create a better lifestyle. People are already creating solar energy and biogas solutions, more village level or homestead level solutions.
There are people working on the climate change issue. There are people working on agricultural issues, food security, HIV AIDS, etc. We cannot deny that population growth is the common factor that could help the missions and agendas of all of these separate groups. There should be more dialogues between those groups. There should be more comprehensive programs being delivered into communities. So until we reprioritize, we're going to continue to just focus on crises that result from population growth issues of the day.
We will need our collective thinking as human. And that's an opportunity maybe to break the barrier between, you know, poor and rich, north and south. I think the planet forces us to define new solidarity projects for the first time maybe in our history.
Overpopulation is a symptom of domination systems. And if we want to change that, we've got to change the system. What is really the kind of world we want for our children? It's about an education that really honors not only human diversity, but natural diversity, honors our Mother Earth. It's about an education that no longer idealizes the kings and the queens and the rulers, but that tells the story of modern times in terms of one challenge after another, one social movement after another challenging entrenched traditions of domination. All of these social movements, including the environmental movements, are really the challenges man's once hallowed conquest of nature. So part of our job is to change the stories.
The story of our history for the last 10,000 years has been a story of domination. But with women who have been nurturing all these years that are now stepping into these new roles of public leadership, you know, all over the world, we can create this tidal wave of change that's not only going to ease our population problem, but it's going to bring about these policies that will sustain a new attitude towards our planet. It's just us. It's one human family, and that we're connected in our challenges, but we're connected in our solutions.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. In the words of the famous stock speculator Jesse Livermore, The game of speculation is the most uniformly fascinating game in the world. But it is not a game for the stupid, the mentally lazy, the person of inferior emotional balance, or the get-rich-quick adventurer. They will die poor. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that stupid and mentally lazy describes almost every single person you encounter at the office, at home, at school, in the checkout line, at the supermarket, in the halls of Congress, every person you listen to on the radio, watch on TV, read in the newspaper, magazine. Yes, we stupid mentally humans have chosen to live in a financialized speculative casino economy, and for that we will die poor. Stacey?
Well, that's the problem with everybody turning to speculation for a living. The bank must burst housing bubble. Of course, this is the latest in the housing bubble here, which is pushed by, on the one hand, by the Treasury Department. Here the OECD is telling the Bank of England that they must burst this housing bubble that one hand of government is blowing up. The other hand of government must push it down. So they're trying to control what the how big and how like movable the bubble is. The Bank of England should invoke new legal powers, allowing it to rein in Britain's booming housing market for the first time. An influential international think tank has said would-be house buyers should have to put down larger deposits, and George Osborne's Help to Buy scheme should be cut back, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development said.
Yes, yes. I like this idea about Jesse Livermore, you know, bringing him into the conversation because he wrote this famous book,
The Bubble It.
The Bible for Speculators. He invented the idea of the modern speculator. And the idea of the speculator, the mindset of the speculator is to really go diametrically opposed to everything that would encompass the attributes of humanity. So in other words, to be a successful speculator, you must have as little empathy as possible. And the point I think you're making here is that as the global economy has become more financialized, moved away from stuff to speculating on speculative contracts, whether it's derivatives, futures, options, the need for people with no empathy increases. And this is why we've got a generation of autistically minded speculator kings who rule the world's economy at the expense of humanity.
Before the 1980s, we humans in the West used to go out, walk to a job. Now we're speculators. And as the infamous Jesse Livermore, who ended up killing himself, by the way, in a hotel in New York City, thinking he was impoverished, but he had $5 million to his name. Lord knows how much that is in today's money. But we're turned into speculators, but we're mentally lazy and stupid. Not only is our education getting worse, by the way, and not only are we mentally lazy watching things like Britain's Got Talent and X Factor and all these things, we are too lazy, most people, because we're so busy, you know, paying off our debts and just keeping those interest payments going.
Well, mentally lazy in the eyes of the speculator. I'm sure Thoreau, who wrote On Walden Pond, would posit that this was, in fact, not being mentally lazy, but being in touch with one's humanity. So what one man's mental laziness is another man's spiritual revelation. This is what's lacking in today's financialized world is any contact at all with a spiritual self, a spiritual being, a spiritual life. And we laud those who are the speculator kings, who by definition lack empathy. That's why the America's foreign policy, of course, is to just invade and shoot first and then ask questions later.
Yeah.
Federal Reserve provided a jaw-dropping
$16 trillion. That wasn't supposed
to happen. The Fed to provide $16 trillion to large financial institutions. Why cannot they begin to move to protect homeowners, unemployed workers, and the
who lack empathy? We've talked about that thousands of times. Those on Wall Street, those making $1 billion a year. There were 10 guys in America that made more than $1 billion last year as hedge fund managers. Those are the professional speculators. However, the 330 million other Americans, the 60 million Brits, that is also what they're trying to do, speculating on housing market. They do not have the same lack of empathy that those who are professionals do have. And yet they're being told this is your future. This is what you should do. Be a stock market speculator. Be a housing market speculator. And yet they don't have the insider trading available to them. They don't have high frequency trading available. They also are too emotional. You can see that on Twitter. People are freaking out about everything. They're shrieking. They love so many people around the world, the Syrians, the Libyans. They want to go rescue everybody. Well, you can't have that sort of mentality and be a successful stock market operator or a successful housing market speculator.
The housing market speculator here in the UK that's driven this enormous historic bubble, I can sum up their current position in one word: unhedged.
Exactly.
That's the difference between a professional speculator and an amateur speculator. The amateur speculator being in this housing market, driving up these prices to these bubblicious levels, they are unhedged. So when the bubble pops, they will lose it all. The professional speculator, like a Blackstone group, they're buying properties all cash and fully hedged. If all these properties were to collapse in value, their exposure on their portfolio would be maybe 1% or 2%, not 120%, 130%.
Well, Blackstone is buying all other people's cash, not their own. Most mom and pops are using their own money and their future, their pension funds. This is what I'm going to show you, why Jesse Livermore said they will all die poor. Pension cash won't solve looming interest-only mortgage crisis. There's an interest-only mortgage crisis ahead, with hundreds of thousands of people having no way to repay their loans when they fall due in the next few years. From 2017, an estimated 40,000 interest-only mortgages held by borrowers aged 65 and over will mature every year. This is in the UK. Now, the average person with this mortgage, interest-only mortgage, reckons that they only will owe £22,000. What the Bank of England, the Financial Conduct Authority, says is actually they're more likely to owe £50,000 from their own data. So they're underestimating how much they'll owe by 50%, and yet their pensions, which they plan on plundering — remember, the Bank of George Osborne is allowing them to plunder their own pension fund soon — well, those hold on average £36,800.
Well, that brings up another fallacy of the amateur speculator, like we see in UK's housing bubble, and that it plays into behavioral economics. In this case, it's confirmation bias is the issue. They underestimate their debt, because to take an honest look at their true debt would be too frightening. So they simply concoct a delusionary view of their debt. So when it finally comes due, they are in shock, and then they have nowhere to go because they're unhedged. And the policy of the banking kleptocratic class that runs the country is to simply cut these people off like a bad cancerous tumor and just say, you speculated, you went bust, we're going to just pull you off the grid, and good luck.
Well, they're stupid and mentally lazy, and that's why the average pension fund is currently worth £36,800, a third less than the average interest-only debt figure. That means those thinking of using their retirement savings to pay off their mortgage will have to think again. But of course, they won't think again because they're mentally lazy, and the chancellor will have to come up with new schemes to encourage a bigger bubble so that their mentally lazy thoughts beforehand will be paid off.
Again, they're mentally lazy in the view of the professional speculating class. Let's take the average worker at the NHS, or maybe the Royal Mail. Maybe they like being doctors. Maybe they like working at the Royal Mail, which these are institutions that are cash flow positive, that perform a vital function in this society. But according to the speculators that run the government and run the kleptocracy, the NHS and the Royal Mail must be financialized, privatized, securitized. And anyone who goes against this ethos of kleptocracy is lazy, is a bum. No. Historically, one could say that they are expressing a need for some spiritual life or some contact with humanity. That's what they would prefer. They would prefer to be more human-like and less drug-addled, speculator autism, suffering lunatics, like you see with Vince Cable, George Osborne, Dave Cameron, Ed Miliband, etc.
Yes, but that's why those guys win, because they do not have empathy. Most normal human beings do, and yet They think they can be successful speculators. Jesse Livermore warned all of us beforehand that we would die poor, and we will die poor because we're all voting, we're all mentally lazy, and we're stupid, and we demand our governments, we demand George Osborne give us bubbles.
Well, the genius of these speculator fascists that run the UK economy and government, like a Cameron, Miliband, Osborne, etc., is to cut off all choices. If you don't want to be a speculator, autistic psychopath or sociopath, there's very little choice. Because if you go to school for something else, let's say you don't want to be a banker in the City of London and possibly jump off the bank and kill yourself in an act of desperation, as so many are now. Maybe that's not the career path you want. Well, to study anything else, you're going to incur so much debt because they financialize the educational institutions. Once you get out, the only job you have that can pay back your debt is to be a psychotic banker at Barclays and risk jumping off a building and creating a sidewalk splat, which, of course, will be financialized by some splat collateralized debt obligation sold by Barclays, who, by the way, all these big banks we now know have life insurance policies on their own bankers. So when they kill themselves or kill other people or commit crime, the bank cashes in, not the family.
And now finally, here's in America, the headline reads, early tap of 401k replaces homes as American piggy bank. The Internal Revenue Service collected $5.7 billion in 2011 from penalties, meaning that Americans took out about $57 billion from retirement funds before they were supposed to. So the median size of the 401k in America is $24,400 as of March 31st this year, with people older than 55 having about $65,300. So they're depleting these small 401k pension funds because they can no longer tap their homes because the American mortgage market is a bit different. But here you have this speculator class dying poor. They're cashing in their 401ks. They talked to one woman who cashed in her pension in order to hire a U-Haul to move to a smaller property.
Look, these people, if they read on Walden Pond Today by Thoreau, the thought that would cross their mind is, how do we frack this pond so I can pay off my mortgage and my gambling debts? All right, Stacey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Max.
Hey, stay tuned for the second half, a whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to go to Sydney, Australia, mate, to talk to Professor Steve Keen, author of Debunking Economics, and he's also an expert in Hyman Minsky. Steve Keen, welcome back to the Kaiser Report.
I'm glad to be here, Max, and I'm going to be a lot closer pretty soon, too.
Oh, that's right. You're taking a job right at a college up the road here. We'll talk about it when you get here. That's congratulations. I wanted to ask you, though, Steve Keen, it's been 6 or 7 years now into the financial collapse, and high house prices in capital cities across the world are booming. What do you think about this?
Well, it's the only thing that the people who are in charge of economic policy right now know how to do is blow bubbles. And they think blowing bubbles is creative economic activity. That's why we had, you know, Greenspan being a cheerleader for rising house prices and trying to say that there was signs of froth in its isolated markets. When you look at the data, American house prices, when you said that, were all over 2 times the long-term average, and they fell back down there again. Of course, the way of getting out of the crisis was to reflate the speculative bubble that's brought capitalism to its creative knees through quantitative easing and techniques like that. And they've succeeded. They've now got people borrowing money yet again to use it to speculate on rising house prices and rising share prices. So, hallelujah, we're back in bubble land again.
Well, this was somewhat predictable because the crash of 2008, which was precipitated by a housing bubble. Remember the subprime crisis was a housing crisis. The response to that was not to reform the bank system at all or to introduce competition into the banking system at all. The solution was to let the too big to fail get even bigger. And the central banks decided that the way out of the mess was to blow another bubble in the stock market and the housing market. So this is exactly what they've done. So they have succeeded in doing what they set out to do. So what will prick the bubble, or will it never get pricked, and we're going to live in a new parallel reality of ever-expanding bubbles, Steve Keen?
We're going to continue seeing expanding bubbles for a while, but expanding bubbles are really fueled by expanding debt. And you've got to pay your debt. You know, if you don't pay your debt, you go bankrupt. But that doesn't mean that what you bought with that debt is going to actually be profitable. It only makes a profit while the price continues rising, and that itself depends upon rising debt levels yet again. So the whole thing is a Ponzi scheme, and Ponzi schemes ultimately are always involving organizations which at the time are fundamentally bankrupt. The only thing that's going to rescue them is continuing rising prices, and the rising prices come from continuing rising debt. So it's a positive feedback loop, and just like, you know, when you go to a concert and somebody whacks the microphone too close to the speaker outlet, bang, at some point it peaks, it crashes, and you come tumbling down the other side. And this time we're going to tumble down from a much higher level of debt than the previous crisis. If you go back to 1990 in America when the last big recession ended back then, the American private debt level got down to about 100% of GDP. It hit 180%. It delevered to about 160% through this crisis, but it's now rising again from a level that almost caused the last crisis. So I think this particular bubble, certainly in the American economy, has got maybe 5 years to go before it hits the same old bloody wall of a Ponzi scheme that has to collapse.
Oh, I like the game. So in other words, on the way up, it's like the amplification system you have from your Fender bass. Once you've got the static feedback, I guess is what they call it, you end up with that shrieking sound, which will in fact be the crash. But let's talk about another economic number, a very specific number, and that is wages. Because during this period of time when house prices are bubbling up to new highs, wages are down 10%. So what is the so-called wealth effect if wages are down? How does that work?
Well, it doesn't work. I mean, the wealth effect is the belief that because we all, inverted commas, feel wealthier, we're going to spend more money out of our increased wealth rather than out of our increased incomes. But the reality is that applies to the point, that applies to the 1%. They're the ones who got wealthier through this huge bubble. And they're not particularly consumers. They're bubble speculators. So they buy the Lamborghinis, some of which catch fire, you may have noticed in Australia just recently. But the real consumers simply aren't consuming. So you're getting very, very early in a recovery, and even normal stage when you've got a recovery going on, you do have rising wages. We have still stagnant wages, but rising asset prices, and the incomes simply aren't there to support mass consumption by the middle class and working class. So I think this is going to be, again, a rather lackluster bubble. The last one, you know, people were in Alabama were getting wealthy, selling, buying junk properties off each other. I don't think they're going to feel that much wealth this time. It's going to be much more restricted to the upper echelons of the wealth distribution, and they'll do very well for a while until the support falls away, and we'll be back in another crash, I'd say in about, as I said, 5 to 10 years.
All right, now, Steve Keen, you are an economist. Therefore, you, as an academic, a scholar, and somebody who does a great deal of writing, would fall into a category of economist. And the categories that you do not fall into would be, let's say, the Keynesians, which believe that this money printing is a good thing to do. I think you would classify yourself as an unorthodox economist or someone who is basically pushing the boundaries of economic thought and coming up with new or extended economic theories. But I'm not sure whether you cover or not this whole idea of behavioral economics. And the reason I ask is because, and I want to get your take on this as an economist, a recent poll found that most Americans believe that housing is the best performing long-term asset of all, better than gold, equities, and bonds, when in fact it was the worst, averaging just 1% per annum over the past 100 years. But the perception for these people who are trapped in the bubble is that it's great. And I believe that falls under the heading of behavioral economics or confirmation bias. But how does that plug into your model when the masses are self-deluding? How does that work?
Well, I'm the conventional belief in economics, the neoclassical model, which they call Keynesian, but it's got bugger all to do with Keynes. It really comes out of Walras and Jevons and people like that. They have this concept of what they call rational expectations. And by rational expectations, what they mean is the capacity to accurately predict the future. They've stolen the word rational and hidden it behind a definition, which if you look at it, means the capacity to make accurate prophecy. Now, the reality is people are rational, but they're rational with relation to the information they have, which is patchy, incomplete, and biased by what they currently know and affected by what the people around them are doing. So if you're rather than having like the rational expectations, which means you would look to the infinite future and be base your knowledge on the infinite past and therefore know that 1% level you're talking about and never expect anything better than 1% out of housing, you actually just look at the local surrounds you've been in, both in time and your locality in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years and 5 or 10 square kilometres around your house. And if you see rising house prices across that time, you think you extrapolate that forward. You extrapolate into the infinite future. So your expectations are rational given what you know, and you know very little. And this is the difference between the way the conventional mob think and why they have this delusional theory of economics and why the sort of stuff that people who call themselves post-Keynesians do and to some extent Austrians and evolutionary economists are much closer to the real world.
Well, it seems in the UK anyway that there is a body of thought or a school of thought that is now warning against this housing bubble. There is a headline in the Telegraph newspaper about the OECD, of course, European-based global think tank, saying that the UK housing bubble needs to pop, that the Bank of England, Mark Carney at the Bank of England, needs to raise rates or do whatever he has to do to pop this bubble, which they consider to be extremely economically dangerous. But you have a basic disconnect between this OECD, what they're saying, and the media and what the politicians are saying in the UK. And everyone here is still saying that you must get on the housing ladder, you must participate in this housing market. It's the only way you can truly be British is to own a home and be highly leveraged. So how come the OECD, which is a huge institution, how come that message doesn't seem to get through into the local media, the BBC or the mindset of the average British person? And are they setting themselves up now for this colossal collapse and negative equity, just like what happened again in 2008?
Yeah, I think we are setting ourselves up for that, but you do have these weird markets, and you know, I'm moving from one weird market to another. Sydney is a weird market where a large part of the price dynamics is set by non-residents, largely Chinese non-residents, buying our new properties and driving up prices that way because Australian prices look cheap to them. And you've got Russian oligarchs buying and Arab sheikhs buying your properties in London. So that particular set of bubbles, because they're driven by something which is completely disconnected from British incomes and Australian incomes, could go on for quite a while. That piece of irrationality could actually succeed for some substantial time. What fascinates me is the point you made about the OECD coming out and warning about bubbles, because these are largely conventional economists who actually were cheerleaders for the bubble the last time round, denying that it existed. Now they're admitting it existed, and I think they sort of see that they've actually generated Frankenstein's monster by their behaviour during the 2000 bubble. So there's an extent to which the economics professional parts of it have learnt their mistake, but they've unleashed this monster of belief in ever-rising asset prices, and of course the central banks, and particularly governments like the England's government with their what I prefer to call help to sell scheme, have fueled the bubble. So it is a crazy, crazy world. As you say, it's like living in a couple of parallel universes that actually intersect and crash each other all the time. It's a weird world to be living in.
Yeah, I want to stay on this OECD comment a little bit because you bring up some good points here. So the OECD is this huge institutional institution in Europe. I mean, it's part of the same institutional mindset that drives the IMF, the World Bank, the ECB. These are huge global institutions. So suddenly they're breaking ranks, which I don't recall in the last 20 years any of these big institutionalized groupthink, money-spending Goliaths breaking ranks in this way. So you believe it's because they've recognized they've created a Frankenstein monster and they can't pretend anymore that this is anything more than just a speculative bubble.
Yeah, I mean, like even the Bank of England has come out and supported the arguments I make about how the money supply is endogenous and therefore the lending the banks do actually causes the inflation and deflation of the economy, in total contrast to the belief of academic economists.
So, let me stop you for a second there. How did you feel? Did you feel vindicated, Steve Keen, when the Bank of England came out and said money is endogenously created? Deposits are, in fact, created through lending. There's no actual organic banking going on whatsoever. It's exactly what you've been saying for years. How did you feel when they came out with that statement?
I felt great, and I have to congratulate them for having the courage to come out and say it, because often these guys are subservient to what they get taught and the people they get taught by in academic institutions. To come out and say, listen, you academics, you're wrong. This is the actual mechanics, and the post-Keynesian side of the world that I come from is right about it, and we have to rewrite economics to make it reflect that. It's a sign that those institutions, which used to be dominated by academic economics, have shifted away, largely because they've got to wear the reality of being wrong. And I'm delighted. I respect the Bank of England's research staff for coming out with that stuff. I respect the OECD for doing the same thing. The International Monetary Fund, with particularly the work of Michael Kumoff, has come out and said that money is endogenous. We've got to include banks in how we think about capitalism. This is true progress, and it's not coming from the academics so much. It's coming from those big institutions, which used to be the ones who led us astray.
Steve Keen is right. The world is wrong. Steve Keen is right. He's coming to the UK. He'll be teaching in the UK. We look forward to seeing you in the UK, Steve Keen. And thanks again. Got to go now. Out of time. Thanks for being on the Kaiser Report.
You're welcome, Mac. Good to be there.
All right. That's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Steve Keen. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Papa, you are so wonderful. Happy Mother's Day, everybody. I think we had a full day today. I feel like I have a lot of children, don't we all? And all the men in the world, you know. You have a feminine aspect of your being. It's just the way it is right now. Bring in the feminine. I wanted to just mention this one little article here. It says, intrigued by Dwarka, Atlantis of the East. And Atlantis of the East. Then you'll love this. Thank you. I am truly humbled that you chose Dwarka, Atlantis of the East, as a touch point on your truth-seeking adventure. However, as you're like most people who watched it, you'll have noticed various questions were left unanswered at the end of the film. Could Dwarka really be the most ancient civilization in human history? Was there or was there not a government cover-up? Did Dwarka truly possess ahead-of-its-time technology? What other ancient scriptures offer clues to the truth about Dwarka? And perhaps most important of all, as we're seeing a mystery like this in Dwarka, what further reality-bending revelations lie buried in other ancient spots across the globe? We believe the answers to these questions will change the world, and behind closed doors, there are people moving closer to them every day. Because as you read this, new artifacts are being unearthed, many that shine light on age-old unsolved mysteries. New studies are underway, often unannounced by the mass media, some revealing historical revelations that could scramble mankind's very perception of reality. And new clues. Rama, where is this Dwarka? Is it off of India on an island off of there? On the east or the west coast?
East.
Off the east, a little more southeast, right? Mm-hmm. This is an island off the southeast coast of India, where this ancient Atlantis city of the east is located, with all this advanced, super advanced technology on there. In the form of these artifacts and these unearthed artifacts, yes. New studies are underway, often unannounced by the mass media, some revealing historical revelations that could scramble mankind's very perception of reality. And new clues and theories are being pieced together at an alarming rate, some which may shatter all perceived notions of human origins.
For instance, you may not have heard that studies on the elongated skulls of Paracas in Peru indicate they may not be 100% human. The Gunung Padang megalithic site in Indonesia is now believed to be 20,000 years old instead of the previous estimated 5,000 years old. A recent discovery of new Mayan codices may change everything we think we know about their mysterious disappearance. After finding animal bones near Stonehenge, researchers now believe the iconic location may have been a sacred hunting ground, and a new genetic analysis of 7,500-year-old skeletons indicates that Europe was once inhabited by an ancient people who mysteriously also vanished. So there's more, but we don't have, not tonight. I just wanted to read that little introduction. We'll play that another time. Everything is changing, everybody, and I mean, we still haven't got a clue of all the stuff that they've not, you know, they've kept silent about. There are aliens amongst us, many, 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 and we are going home. Okay. So I'll read that first chapter in chapter 3 again. This is from our sister, the Reverend Venerable Dahani Yahu. In the book called Learning Cherokee Ways, The Yahu Path. Recognizing space of wisdom arising. The most obvious expression of Native American view shown to me by my elders was the awareness of energy potential and the clarity of what was energized. Their consciousness in many ways was like a clear lake. They did not react to things. They observed me as though I were observing myself in a mirror. Sometimes I thought it was positively passivity they expressed, an ultimate quiet. Then as the day would go on, there was a sense of expectancy or potential as they were careful about what they chose to energize. As children, we would often test them. I would expect especially to see as I could get a rise out of them because others around them would get angry or annoyed. Yet the elders did not express annoyance, nor did they express anxiety. They were like mirrors reflecting back to me what I was doing and what I was saying. The equanimity they displayed was amazing. Seeing this lucidity and quiet, yet ready for action quality, made it clear to me that I, too, was in charge of my own life and my own mind. Their way of being and ultra-clarity protected them from projections of racism or culture that others sought to defend them with, and allowed them to maintain their spiritual sovereignty. After my initial experiences of all my senses being tuned up and sensing my own inner rivers or pathways, I understood a little more about why it was important to exercise. The exercises I appreciated in that moment were the dances that our elders taught. I realized there was a really good reason for everything they did and said. They were wise to refrain from getting excited or attached to other people's words and troubles. In this way, they made space for people to see solutions where they had only seen before. Turn the page. Obstacles. As a lady named Violet came to visit, I sensed there was a big sorrow in her heart. She was hoping for healing and was willing to do anything she needed to do, or so it appeared. One day, as she was leaving, I said to her, "Please do not kill the baby." I want to play with the baby. She was surprised that I saw she was planning an abortion. She seemed to be tied around a tree, not knowing which way to turn to free herself. Looking at her husband, I could see why. He was like a heavily banked fire, more ash than light. She was getting tired and wanted to go. My grandparents would just listen and offer tea. People who wanted healing had to come in the right way, usually four times. People who seemed to get the best results were those who approached the elders respectfully, with an open heart and an open mind. Some people came expecting, quote, "These Indians will do something for me," unquote. Those who got results approached my grandparents with the view that they would shed light on the matter at hand. My grandparents insisted the person seeking assistance do something before coming back, so they would recognize that they are responsible for and capable of manifesting what appears in their lives. The meetings with my grandparents were also an education, and they would go home with something that would enrich their lives. Violet came many times and did everything they asked. First, they told her to put bowls of water and flowers in her bedroom. Then she came back. They told her to put salt in the corners of the room and white chalk under her bed. She did, and there was still sorrow in her heart and rage at her husband. I think she finally left him, and I do not believe the child was born. My grandparents gave both of them homework. They had come from far away places, both geographically and emotionally. I asked as this distance is why they had and did not get along. The answer was both yes and no. Where there is love and ease, distances do not mean anything. I learned that sometimes healing does not bring people what they think they want. Often people think they wanted their lover to keep loving them or for their husband to do this or that. My grandparents would tell me later that their wanting was often the cause of their illness and their suffering, because they were not nurturing the potential of love within. People who would say, quote, "Please make a medicine that to have my husband love me," unquote, were invited to gather flowers and to gather herbs and to reflect upon their life situation. They would come to understand they did not need to control one another, and the love that they were seeking was within. This observation would change the dynamic of the whole relationship. My grandparents expressed a love that was inclusive and not possessive. It seemed a good model for loving cooperation. The people can ask to be healed of something that is not a disease. The remedies that were offered of water bowls and flowers were offered to lift up their spirits, to liven the heart, to disintegrate the stench of anger. As I observed my grandparents' capacity as medicine people, I felt I was being encoded with information. Through observation, they impressed me so I would remember what they showed. The core of their remedies was above reconnecting with love in one's heart. They would say, quote, "Illness comes when there is discord with family, when sacred places are disturbed,
when a person has a gift and does not use it. When you start to do something and do not finish it, and as you receive the calling to accomplish something and do not apply the gift. They taught people how to soften the seed pod around their heart through dreaming, so the reconnections to each other could be more clearly revealed. The seed pod around the heart is made from holding patterns of fear and anger and blame and the scars of the hurt one has experienced. Some of those wounds go back to childhood and the wounds of the family. My grandparents showed me how to heal these wounds. As one was skillful, one could assist in the healing of the whole family and their ancestors by transforming the scar tissue or potential around the heart. We learned each person can choose what they energize. They can focus on the hurt or on the accomplishment of what was learned through experience. Okay, Captain Don, can you call my sister Rainbird, all of our sister Rainbird? Commander Don. All right. A-okay. Ole. Okay, I'll read a little more, everybody. As my grandparents spoke, the tones of their voices seemed more musical than factual. Their voices would play off each other, weaving through the person's body, gently loosening adhesions and pain. My grandfather had a gift. He could actually put his hand inside a person and pull out stagnant clots of hope gone sour. This was just their minor healing work, as they called it. That's what the psychic surgeons from the Philippines did. I got to witness that in my own body. Completely consciously, I got to witness this psychic surgeon. She put her whole hand in between my ribs and went into the back of my lungs from the front, through my ribs in the side. Unbelievable. That was pretty strong medicine. Major healing would occur in a cabin with pulled down shutters to make it black inside. On the dirt floor, they would sit and rattle and work a small drum with water in it. They went to the very source of discord and disease and brought to it resolution. On these occasions, the father of my grandmother would come. When he came to work in a medicine way, he always wore a special jacket. People called him Cherokee Hunting Jackets. Yet I do not believe he was hunting any animal. He was hunting the cure. Careful, Rama.
Okay.
You scared me. He was hunting the cure, that elusive sense of balance that brought resolution to disease. This jacket fascinated me with its applique and its embroidery. It had pictures on it, deeply involved with geometric shapes that conveyed whole encyclopedias. Just looking at it would take me into other worlds. This jacket was alive. It actually expressed what he was thinking and what people in the room were thinking. One could even see herds of animals moving across his jacket. It was a living hologram of the entire planet. Okay, that's a mysterious place to stop.
Yeah.
And I passed this long, very long story-stemmed Excalibur, Rainbow Rose, Emerald Serpent, Quetzalcoatl Feathered Talking Stick back to my sister Rainbird.
Oh, I like that talking stick. Thank you. And I like that Dehani Yahoo. And wow, what a place you just took us. And it just reminded me of my many teachings with my elders. And seeing those deer on the jacket reminded me of smoking from Sitting Bull's pipe, watching him load that pipe and watching every animal go into that pipe. So I've seen that, yeah, I've seen that. There's holograms out there. And lots of gratitude for her. And I also wanted to share with you, Tara, that Dehani means venerable. I read that in the beginning of the first book that you read. And I thought that's interesting. Anyway, I wanted to share that. And I'm so grateful for all that you shared today so much since 9.5 hours ago. You covered a lot of corners of the universe in many different layers and dimensions. And lots of gratitude for all that you do. And so happy Mother's Day to you. And to you too, Rama. I know that mother inside of you that comes forward as well. Happy Mother's Day to Mother. And to all the happy Mother's Day to all the men in the world for them recognizing their own femininity and balancing that within them, and vice versa. So lots of gratitude to be here, to be alive. And so grateful for all the people that contribute to these calls, Penny and Richard and Cheryl. Diani. And who am I forgetting? Angel Sue, Marita. So, lots of gratitude for all of you that show up and bring your gifts as well. We're grateful for all of you. Thank you. Thank you, thank you for joining us and making this circle possible and all that we do here. Much gratitude for this rainbow round table. Council Fire. All the ones who join us, like Max Kaiser and Bernie Sanders and all these good ones. So, thank you. 13 thank yous and honey in the heart. And I pass this talking stick over to you, Rama. What you got for us tonight?
Oh my, Rama, Rama's got something up his sleeve here. This is a Sufi Rumi poem. It's called Hu, The Zikr by Anand Murti Guru Ma, Sufi Zikr Meditation. Let's do that. All right. And then we've got a song after that. Very, very good. Okay, here we go.
Jalaluddin Rumi says, "The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door sill. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. I would love to kiss you. The price of kissing is your life. Now, my loving is running towards my life, shouting. What a bargain. Let's buy it. A seeker. But before becoming a seeker, one has to become a lover. You cannot become a lover if you have failed of worldly attachments. World is here in front of us to give us experiential knowledge, understanding that it is changeable, transient entity. Laugh, sing, dance, make love, have children, create houses, money and power. And yet in a moment, death snatches everything and leaves you shivering, shaking in fear and ultimately drowning in unconsciousness. It is not possible to taste the divine wine of love if you haven't met a sheikh, a mystic. One has to become a ney, a reed flute. One has to become empty, whole. Then all the poetry and all the music will come through you. This divine love occupies heart and mind. And then all universe seems as if it is just the beloved peeping to us from behind the sun, behind the stars and moon. Flowers and trees, men and women, children and old. Once this divine love makes its roots in the heart, person gets overwhelmed, drenched in this beautiful experience where the mind goes into the zone of silence. The whole universe then exhibits the divine dance of love. One who has surrendered to the Lord is called a Sufi. And Sufi sings the zikr. La ilaha illallahu. There is no reality but God. There is only God. Zikr has three parts. The first is the denial of everything visible. Second is the explosion into the individual. And the third part is the outbreathing of divine presence. Who? Sufi sings who? That which is, that which was, that which will be. World becomes nothing more than an image stitched with gold thread on the tapestry, just a playful addition. Drunk in love, the lover calls out in longingness to the one who resides in the heart, but still seems so far. Nobody wishes a heaven if the price is death. Nobody will wish for immortality if the cost is death. But this is what love is, death. But from this arises the resurrection of new you, pure, virgin, loveful. And now the calls of the heart get answered. Until the ego is alive, there is no possibility of love to happen. When darkness of ego is blown away with loneliness, urgency, search of the truth, this becomes possible. For Jalaluddin Rumi, it happened when Shams Tabrizi arrived and stole his heart and mind. And then the love occupied this vacuum. Once someone asked Shams, whose head was full of ideas and desires, he said, "Tell me about divine mystery." Shams said, "I can tell you the mystery. I can tell this mystery only to someone in whom I can see myself. This mystery I will tell only to myself. I don't see myself in you. I see someone else." The mind has to be emptied of all attachments, greed, passion, darkness. And for this the teacher, the Sheikh, has to hit love until the mind is shattered. The existence of the beloved cannot be proven physically, nor it is a fantasy. This presence at best has been given many, many names in different cultures, yet the presence remains nameless. You may call it Allah, Brahma, reality, truth, or any other word, because that is what best a mind can try to do, give the name to the nameless. The Sheikh is a mirror, a reminder of that presence. Understanding of this mystery comes through the Sheikh, and it transforms all the energies of the seeker. Rumi said, "I have phrases and whole pages memorized, but nothing can be told of love. You must wait until you begin to live the love. Be patient, utterly patient. The journey which begins from love towards God, a moment comes in this journey when finally the union happens. All boundaries get dissolved. Then this I is no more different from that." As Al-Hillaj Mansur cried out, "Anahak, I am that." And then total emptiness. I is no more. So who will call whom? Just a vast emptiness, which is best described by Sufis as who, that which exists. Who means that which was and will be. No word can ever contain the infinitude presence once the consciousness arises after this volcanic experience. On asking, "What happened to you?" Sufi says, "Oh."
body from east to west. So we got to pull this.
Are you ready for bed, little one? There you go.
Okay, let's take this over here. Okay, one more, everybody. This is back over to Pavarotti here, and a little friend of here that Hans is singing with him. Here we go.
Okay. So much from the world. My voice gave it to me such an incredible satisfaction. It's making you think what is important in the world today. Why should not I try to give the thing back?
Bodies on 34s, feet bodies falling on, and old bodies turning off, this soul is blasting off.
About it as much as we do. Wherever I sing around the world, I always include one of the most famous songs about longing for Italy. It is about Sorrento, a beautiful town on cliff above the sea, just south of Naples.
In tal cuore se ne va.
All right, now we got Happy Mother's Day. That was Sting that was singing there with... Pretty amazing, huh? East meets West, and that's the way it is for tonight. Until we see you again, hopefully, maybe tomorrow night and Monday night with Cheryl Croce at... quarter of the hour of 9 on the East Coast and a quarter of the hour of 6 on the West Coast. And the same number, 213-342-3000. Then the PIN is 9467441#. I really believe that we have made some changes here, like we said, this Stargate that opened here in April. It's never been here before. Let's do our part. Tag, we are all it together. Namaste, everyone. Love you so much. Till we meet again. Au revoir. Namaste. Sat Nam.
Sat Nam.
Sat Nam. Gee.